Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Okay, so as we kind of closed out our last episode, I was kind of leading down this path of, you know, the words we use and how those words are put together and how they're perceived. As I was saying, we the people is kind of code words for progressives to say democracy, mob rule. We, you know, every voice, every vote counts, that all that kind of crud. And I'm not saying that the NLA is anything like I'm not trying to be like a John Birchers and trying to, you know, go after the NLA for using that. But I don't think people really understand when they use those terms, we the people. It puts into, because the education system has been driving this in, that we are a democracy. We're a democracy. And so being sensitive to that, I'm just only a little bit sensitive to making sure that people understand that we're not talking about implementing democracy. People understand that we are a Republican form of government, most of these people. But what ends up happening is they start focusing on those kinds of words, and we lose sight of the representation of our form of government, if that makes sense. So when we come back, we're going to have Eric Levy, and we're going to finish this conversation and hopefully answer most of his questions, if not all of them. So please stay tuned, and we will be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
All right, folks, we are back with Eric Levy. And it's Levy?
My family pronounces it Levy. Levy, I don't really mind either way.
All right. It's an identity. So identities are important. You're talking to the guy that has probably the worst reputation with getting names right. Anyway, so where were we? I think we were talking about the list of grievances, and we were talking about organizations. And I think when we were leaving, and you were making this position regarding the NLA, that the NLA wants to go down this path. There is one, so I'll just be full disclosure right here. I do have a problem with the concept, because common law and the people may have been, and there may have been room for the people being able to create common law grand juries prior to our Articles of Confederation. Maybe, you know, back with the states and so forth, because at that point in time, our form of government was not galvanized in the states and, you know, as a Republican form of government. We had general power constitutions within most of these states. And so the states enjoyed all of these privileges in ruling or governing their people. From the Declaration of Independence into the Articles of Confederation, and then finally galvanized within the Constitution of the United States, we have a Republican form of government. In other words, we are to have representation do our government for us, because the framers saw that democracy and mob rule was a quick path to anarchy and then tyranny. Anarchy and tyranny. So a democracy constantly always teeters back and forth between those types of things, because if the people don't get what they want, then they go into anarchy, and then they find the next despot to, you know, take over. And that's exactly what happened out of the French Revolution. So with the new constitution and a republican form of government, and especially, and I think I already went through the Roger Sherman American republicanism definition with you, where representation is not just limited to we the people as the only sovereigns, that sub-elements of government that we've created, such as the state government, such as the county government, they are our sovereigns as well. We give them and delegate to them power and have sovereignty over the things we give them power. Is that not correct?
We delegate to them certain authority. Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. That's correct.
In other words, it's a democracy. You may have a figurehead, but if the final say has to always go back to the people for a vote or for the final say, then that's a democracy. But if your county commissioners have the ability to where they can do and administer laws in accordance to what the powers they've been delegated, then they have sovereignty over those powers. And it's the same thing at the state level. So Roger Sherman, he said that, hey, we have created a level of sovereignty that needs representation within our government, because within the state, the counties have desperate interests. If you look at the coastal counties, where the majority of the money and the majority of the influence may come from easily, that's where you have population centers. The intent was that without a true Republican form of government, a representative form of government, population centers could really start dictating and running the government of the state. However, if you equalize and you recognize representation of the counties, then every county has equal say. And that was the whole point of the Senate as well, that the states had equal say over those powers that were delegated to the Senate. This is one of the reasons why most people cannot understand and cannot describe bicameral legislative bodies. There was a reason why the representatives of the people were given those types of powers, and that the Senate was given different types of powers to ensure that those who understood the business of the state were delegated the powers over, you know, the interstate commerce, interstate regulations, education, those types of things, where the people were concerned about their militia service, you know, going to war and fighting. And they wanted those people to protect them and the counties to protect their interests as well. And so understanding, and so this is all about republicanism, and understanding that our government had been galvanized by the Constitution as a Republican form of government, which means that it is really a violation of the Constitution for the people to take government into their own hands. We have to elect representatives. Even the committees of correspondence were the representatives of the people. And I think you and I had a conversation regarding the committee.
And I was saying that the committees of correspondence were a subcommittee of the committees of safety. Yes.
So actually, the committees of correspondence created committees of safety, because it was at that point in time when they made. So what had to happen is the committees of correspondence had to basically take the stand. We're going to go to war. We're going to declare independence. We're creating this Continental Congress, and we're taking the steps necessary. Because as the states were appealing to Britain and the king, they were just being ignored. They were constantly being ignored. So they said, okay, let's unify to try to send one last message. And they did. They made another appeal. Thus, it created, because I think the appeal went at the end of 1775 or early 1776, and it still fell. As a matter of fact, if you read the Tory Acts, they even talk about this. And I think they even talk about creating the committees of safety at that point in time, because they knew that they were going to be going to war, and they had to create these committees of safety. This was all before the Articles of Confederation. And so the Tory Acts actually kind of help kind of give you a good picture of how things were constructed at that point in time, because clearly the committees of correspondence, and I know the listeners are probably getting confused about what we're talking about, because this is into the historical minutiae of government. But nevertheless, moving into this question, or let me, you know, reposition myself on this republicanism. The people themselves, when they take the power themselves to manage government, then we have moved away from a republican form of government. So at the county level, we have sovereigns. Our sheriff, and as we know, and the NLA has identified very specific people that are elected that can summon and call grand jury, common law grand juries. The county commissioners are another. They are our sovereigns at the county level, technically. If you look at the sheriff is only the executioner. He is the only one that's to enforce the laws and to ensure that only constitutional laws are enforced. But the county commissioners, it would be great if we could get county commissioners, because they also have budget, right? So it would be great if we could get county commissioners to actually create common law grand juries. But this concept of the people being able to just convene their own, in their own vacuum, a common law grand jury flies in the face of that representative form of government. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It makes total sense. I understand it completely. But something that, you know, the Constitution isn't, and it is galvanized, but it obviously it had some flaws. It is the best piece of it's the best government that man's ever produced. But understand that we too have lost our voice, just as our founders did. They couldn't get Parliament or the king to listen. And we're not saying at the NLA that we want to have a rogue grand jury. We expect fully to be inside the courthouse. Here's the problem. Also, one more thing. The county, the thing you're bringing up is absolutely, yes, the county. So many things I've come across in my studies. In fact, we were just discussing it today or recently in Bible study with Brent Allen Winters. He was talking about how the counties in the southern states were deciding whether or not they would leave or stay with the Union. They would leave the Confederacy or not be a part. You see what I'm saying? They would secede from the Union is what I mean to say. And so many things were done at the county level. In fact, that's how our government is set up. And yes, it is a Republican form of government, but it is not a republic. Now, Brent makes this point all the time.
Sure.
A republic is really it's the same thing as a democracy. You can just look at the republics around the world.
Right.
They're tyrannical governments. So the thing that makes America special is the common law. Now, I see what you're saying, and everything you said did make perfect sense.
So if I could just inject this one thing, because I think this will actually make the connection for you. Clearly, in the Declaration of Independence, after a train of abuses, the people have the right to overthrow their government. So let me kind of give you this paradigm. We just kind of look to our left of, you know, governments and form and so forth. When we're at a point where the people have reached that level, when the people say we need to, you know, you convene these grand juries, that in tantamount is literally taking that step to say we're going down the path of overthrowing our government.
Well, just know that all we... Now, I feel comfortable saying this because I've been part of the NLA for a long time. It's not just my opinion, but the idea is that what we want to set up are grand jury administrators. Okay, so, you know, Brent Winters, he talks about this too, that having a full-time staffed prosecutor is a relatively new thing in American history, around the 1930s. It's when it started to happen. You used to not have a full-time prosecutor. If the county or any municipality had to sue someone, they would hire someone. But you can see what an absolute train wreck this has become. Indict a ham sandwich. I mean, that's like saying, I don't want to be vulgar here, but that's like using the Constitution and the Holy Bible for toilet paper, okay?
Right.
You can indict a ham sandwich. And as I say it, the prosecutor and the judge together are guilty of a level of racketeering that would make a mob boss blush, and this is in every village, town, city, county, across the union. So what we're saying is we need a grand jury administrator, someone who will orientate the grand jury and the petty jury, and it must be one of the people. That's what we're saying. We're not saying we need to overthrow the Constitution, not even a little. We think the Constitution is fantastic, but do you see my point?
No, I do. And as a matter of fact, I agree, and I'll even go one step further. I believe the county needs a true executive. If you understand the role of the executive, see, the counties actually existed prior. And do you understand the intent of a county?
Well, I mean, if you want to go all the way back to Deuteronomy 18, Exodus 18,
I'm talking about here in America. They gauged a county based on the amount of travel in one day it would take for a citizen to vote. They believed that the travel requirement could not exceed one day for somebody to enjoy suffrage. And so that's why counties were formed and sheriffs and seats were created. See, the most important role that the counties had prior to the Constitution was voting. And the sheriff was the one who determined whether a person was a citizen of that county, whether they owned the appropriate amount of land and everything else. He had the final say whether you could vote or not.
Okay, I see what you're saying, but I mean, that's, you know, I mean.
So back in those days, they didn't have legislators. They didn't have sovereigns of county commissioners. It was after the Constitution that we started creating truly sub-elements of government of county supervisors and commissioners so that they would be able to organize their needs to their representatives in the Senate. And so the sheriff was the first. I honestly believe, in addition to these possible administrators, I honestly believe that we need an executive as well to have a balance between the inter-county relationships, because the sheriff, his job is to enforce the laws of the county and ensure constitutional laws are carried out. He's not responsible for inter-county commerce and creating agreements between counties of, you know, judicial. Let's just say you live in a rural area and one county just can't afford anymore to have its own, to maintain separate jails. So you have these five counties work together in creating a unified jail system, like a unified school district. And so the concept of creating an executive that could actually start answering those, because the sheriff is limited, his jurisdiction is completely limited to that. But giving an executive the ability to create these types of treaties for the county commissioners to actually be able to invoke and work together, I honestly see that there's more of a need for an executive at the county level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I like where you're going. But I just want to make clear, you know, I understand drawing the boundaries for a county not having to travel more than one day for suffrage and such, but no, I just want to make it clear that counties, you know, this is a part of our Anglo-Saxon heritage, and it does go back to the days of Moses and his father-in-law, Jethro. But yeah, just, you know, they used to be called shires. I mean, counties are a big part of our Anglo-Saxon heritage,
right.
But I do see exactly what you're saying. But, you know, these new offices that have been created, yeah, they're a part of the problems that we're talking about throughout our discussion.
I completely agree, because the county prosecutor, 9 times out of 10, they are either blindly corrupt or directly corrupt, if that makes sense. And so there probably needs to be a review to where you have an elected position. I don't know if you have administrators, like you have a county clerk. The question is, can a county clerk actually be the person to be the county administrator as well, to where they, you know, they have the ability? And as a matter of fact, this is where they, the county clerk actually gets a little teeth in county government, because they become that voice of the people at the county level to determine whether something needs to be done or not. And this is the person that you change. You don't necessarily change, you know, the, you know, a gun-toting county clerk, but what you do is you change them to basically adhere to the desires that we consider our sheriff corrupt. We want you to convene a grand jury against them, or the prosecutor, and or the commissioners. It's a separation of powers. But the question I have is, would the county clerk be able to do this and change the roles, responsibilities, and powers of the county clerk instead of just creating a new office? That's something to ponder and think about. Because
it is something to think about. But I really believe, you know, and obviously I'm partial to NLA, but I believe the grand jury administrator could solve a lot of these problems, kind of like you were saying, right, Madison, looking at the base of the mountain hey, you don't have to sweat all the details.
Right. So here's the question. Can you vest these powers of a grand jury administrator into the roles, responsibilities, and powers of the clerk, elevating the county clerk now in a balance of powers within the county? Because I can tell you that every time, if you're dealing in most states that believe in limited government, they don't want to see more seats created. The question is, you know, what do you do if you're all of a sudden really abiding by the Constitution, everybody's behaving well? Then you're paying for a level of government you don't need. So I'm just saying that as a suggestion to the people, so that the people don't look at paying for more government by creating extra seats, just making sure that role, responsibility, and power, and that representation for the voice of the people to stand up and say, we need to hold this person accountable by a grand jury. There you go.
Right. Right. And you know, and John Durash will make this point, certain county organizations, and I'm not going to be too specific here because we get into a whole other chestnut, but they will disappear once we the people govern ourselves, once we the people will decide on whether or not we will actually use the law, we'll use jury nullification, we the people will decide whether or not we'll allow the government to take property, life, liberty, or property. We'll decide the punishment. We'll decide on the law. And at this point, these, as John Durash says, some of these organizations will simply disappear for the sole fact that their whole budget comes from fleecing us, and they'll become extinct. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And so I honestly think that when the vernacular of what you just used, and so I would just say you may want to listen to how you said that. When you look at the vernacular, you look at how Thomas Jefferson talked about democracy and the people and so forth. He was never a fan of democracy, but he used the terms and vernacular that made people think. And that's one of the reasons why he referred to the Republican Party as the Democratic Republican Party, that the people would decide, that the people, technically, you know, Jefferson was always talking about, well, we need to convene delegates to, you know, so when the people decide, they decide via a delegate to send to the state convention or a county convention to determine the powers, whether the state or the county needs to have these powers, and whether we get rid of them, rewrite the Constitution. And I believe counties need to have enumerated constitutions as well. That at the state level, we need to have, just like in Article 1, you have Section 9 and Section 10, where, you know, the Section 9 are restrictions placed upon the federal government, and Section 10 are restrictions placed upon the state government. We need to have something very similar within the state constitutions, that, you know, the state says, okay, we're not going to do these things, but counties, you can't do these things either. kind of, if that makes sense. And so, but it has to be done through delegates of the people, not as a single voice. As a matter of fact, when Madison talked about, and this was on June 6th in the Virginia ratification debates, when Henry started pointing at the Constitutional Convention creating a democracy, this we the people, and he was mocking the Constitution, Madison said, well, who are the parties to it? We the people? Not we the people as one body. We the people of the 13 sovereign states, that the states were the delegates for the people in this Constitution. And so it's the same thing when you have a, just like the Constitutional Convention, they didn't have the people involved in writing that. They sent delegates from each state, Madison being one of them. Governor Randolph, I think there was a couple of governors that were involved in the state constitution or the U.S. Constitutional Convention. So the point is that when we look at, you know, all of these types of things, if we keep it in context of Republican delegates and these types of things, then, you know, people won't hear that we, you know, the people are going to do this. The people are going to do this. We keep it in a Republican form, or I should say a Republican form of government. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Okay. It does. But I'm trying to find, I'm trying to think of where I saw this Jefferson quote, because what he says is exactly what I just brought up in Exodus 18, with Jethro visiting his son-in-law, Moses. Mm-hmm. And he talks about boiling this down. He talks about, I think he refers to it as true federalism. And he talks about boiling it down that the people will have local control. And I understand what you're saying about the delegates, mm-hmm. but I really want you to see this this quote from Jefferson. But he breaks it down in this. I mean, he uses more words, of course. He says it in so many more words, and you know, he had a way of speaking, which I love. But basically, he says what Jethro says to Moses, and he says, every great matter they shall bring to you, by any small matter they shall decide themselves. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. And he says, then he goes on to say how we're going to break it down.
Right.
He says, Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, right. Chiefs of thousands, hundreds, right. Fifties, and tens. And so, you know, you'll hear Brent Winters talk about this, and he's, you know, you break these down, and it's townships and shires. That's what this is. It's, you know, it's a number of families.
Yeah, but in context to that theocracy, because Moses was the one that chose who was to be the judges, not the people. And so, and because that's a theocracy, right? I mean, Moses was the prophet, and and theocracies work a lot different than our republic. And so we, the people, have, you know, and the framers understood this, why that's why they created the safeguard from a democratic form of government to ensure a republican form of government. But ultimately, as Jefferson boiled it down in the Declaration of Independence, that we have an inalienable right to overthrow our government after a train of abuses. And that comes down to that. And that's why I say, when we go down the path of the we the people ganging together, that is, are we tantamount to stating the same thing? Are we ready to say we've got to overthrow all of this? We've got to cast off this government and create a new one. And I would say that's probably not true. 9 times out of 10, when people use that in context, I would say that, you know, we want to use the mechanisms that we have. We haven't even exhausted one of these mechanisms, if you understand what I'm saying. This is why it is important to get on board and actually challenge our sheriffs, actually challenge our county commissioners and all of these other people to exercise their authority in enforcing the Constitution, in summoning common law grand juries to make these declarations that our constitutional rights were denied unconstitutionally by public servants at every level of government. And that because Section 3 clearly states that you cannot violate the Constitution and be eligible to hold a public seat, all of these people are to be dismissed or disqualified. So as I pointed out to to many other people, when these declarations get done, who do they go to? Do they go to the state attorney general? No, these actually go to the Secretary of State, the person that's responsible for a qualification of office. When a public servant is no longer qualified, I believe it is the Secretary of State that says you're no longer qualified to sit in that seat. You know, you have to step down. It's not that this person has committed a crime. They're just no longer qualified to be in that seat anymore. So there's no jury. There's no trial. There's no due process offered a public servant. When you've disqualified yourself, you must be removed from office.
Okay. Right. And I agree. And again, I want to say that we don't think it's come to where we have to overthrow.
No. I understand that. But what I hear from other organizations interpolating, and so I'm just saying that when people hear that type of thing, the vernacular comes out as the we the people, democracy, exercising our ultimate right, that type of thing. And so I think this may be my role and job, because I believe that I am to unify and bridge people together so that they can work together in the ultimate end of compliance to the Constitution. Because there's a lot of different organizations that if they started working together, if we started uniting instead of maintaining our division and the divisiveness that has driven us in these directions, that we can actually overcome these problems very quickly and very easily. And we'll get the people behind us, because as the people become educated, I truly, and you've probably heard me use this premise before, reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree. If the problem's that middle part, they're just not equally informed. So once people are actually informed on, they can't be doing this and this is what has to happen, they go, wow, how come we didn't know this before? Well, this actually supports this whole concept of disbanding the national indoctrination system and getting back to educating people at the state and local levels instead of having a national curriculum and agenda being driven down our throats.
Yes.
So anyway,
let's
segue into this last topic that has these, kind of boils these two questions together. Can the general government and state government create religious laws and unrighteous laws? And, this concept of organizational preservations placing priority on the organization over the Constitution. The federal government, the general government, cannot create any laws in respect to religion, nor can they create unreligious laws or unrighteous laws. So when the general government started creating laws about separation of church and state, it in itself is an unrighteous law or a law respecting religion. If it has something to do with religion, it is a law respecting religion. Whether it's disrespecting it or not, it's a law in context to religious law. And therefore, the federal government, general government, they can't put those types of words on ink, or you can't put that ink on paper. They can't form those sentences. They are denied by the Constitution the ability to form those sentences. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
And so, so when all of a sudden the federal government says there shall be no churches related to government, they just basically stated a religious entity. They created, in essence, and established a religion of no religion. Because when you make a stance on religion, whether it's this religion, that religion, or no religion, it is a religious stance.
Yeah.
In other words, they've created a secular religion that there should be no other religion but our non-religion. And whatever that non-religion is and how they want to define it creates doctrine and dogma.
Yes. And just, a fun fact, there is a new domination called in the Christian church called was not new. It's called non-denominational. I mean, it just proves your point. But I hear you loud and clear.
Right. So the framers used that term secular back in their age. before non-denominational ever became, you know, a known word. A non-denominational actually became a practiced word in the, you know, late 1800s and 1900s. Secularism before that was just, you know, a non-affiliation of the denominations, but it did not mean that America may have been secular, but it was still Christian. It just wasn't denominational.
Mm. Yeah.
And so here's the thing. When John Adams said that America was not a Christian nation, he was lying, because every state in the Union at that point in time had state-sponsored churches, and they were all Christian-sponsored churches.
Yes, exactly. Right, yeah, he was lying.
Because the federal government has no power to establish a church. It has to recognize that the states do have the power to establish a church. And so the real solution to all of this whole problem is we have to understand that secularism or godlessness is the essence of the Antichrist church.
Yeah. Look. You take God out of the church, what, in the early 60s, and look at our precipitous decline. But look, you got to let me read this quote to you. It's not long.
Oh, go ahead.
True federalism, this is Tom Jefferson. The way to have good and safe government is not to trust it all to one, but to divide it among the many, distributing to everyone exactly the functions he is competent to. Let the national government be entrusted with the defense of the nation and its foreign and federal relations. The state governments with the civil rights, law, police, and administration of what concerns the state generally. The counties with the local concerns of the counties and each ward direct the interests within itself. It is by dividing and subdividing these republics from the great national one down through all its subordinations until it ends in the administration of every man's farm by himself, by placing under everyone what his own eye may superintend, that all will be done for the best. What has destroyed liberty and the rights of man in every government which has What has destroyed liberty and the rights of man in every government which has ever existed under the sun? The generalizing and concentrating all cares and powers into one body. End quote.
So when was that quote written?
You know, it doesn't have a date by it, but that would be easy enough to find, I'm sure.
Okay.
I'm assuming it's going to be sometime between 1775 and 1785. That's a guess.
Okay, so Madison in the Federalist Papers 10, if you've heard of his angels, if men were angels, it basically states something very similar. And in that, Madison's diatribe really focuses on, you know, how to control government. But Madison, I love how he goes into factions and how factions within the people create the greatest schisms and the greatest problems in managing the people and in the importance of unification. But anyway,
Adams thing that you said, I do believe he was lying too. And I don't know the context he said it in, but it is curious to me. And you brought it up and you said he's lying. I think he was lying. He also turns around and says, our government was made for moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. So, I'm just curious what you have to say about that.
And he was lying in that statement as well. Because I don't think he understood the brilliance and in the divine hand of providence. Do you think that the divine hand of providence would have known that there would be maniacal people with machinations to move this government into creating an Antichrist church and to move this nation and its people into anti-Christianity and into secularism to where we would become a godless nation? Do you think he knew that?
Do I think Adams knew it, or do I think the Creator knew it?
The Creator, the divine hand of providence.
The divine hand. Of course, he knows everything. That's one thing he can't do is learn, because he knows it all.
So this is where it comes into his brilliance, because he gave us an instrument that was not a theocracy that could be thrown off. He gave us an instrument of a compact that in the maturity of contract law, the people could reel back in, even a godless nation, the people could reel back in the nation of this Antichrist church and put it back into context to get it out of its anti-Christian promoting faith and allow the people to heal themselves by enforcing compliance of the compact, by dismantling this Antichrist church that was created by these maniacal men, these nefarious players. We now have the ability, because he gave us a compact. He says, hey, these things are outside the boundaries of this compact. These are clearly breaches and violations of our compact. You cannot create a godless church and force us. You have no ability to make any laws respecting religion or no religion at all.
Yes, yes. And heal ourselves, 2 Chronicles 7:14, right. But by turning our face back to God and confessing our sins, and Deuteronomy 28, I mean, yes.
But so what you're saying, because this is where I hear pastors all the time, and when I get their ear and I have a chance to sit down with a local pastor, this is what they say. They say, we have to have a third awakening. They're all crying for a third awakening. And I say, then you have to look at the Constitution as a compact. You have to teach your people that this is a compact, that the federal government has no power vested in it, has no power delegated to it to establish a church or to have any regulations at all regarding the expression of religion. In doing so, it gets in republic review, enforcing the federal government into compliance of the compact, unencumbers all these churches to now be able to do what they need to do. It's not for the government to create the third awakening. It's for them. But see, this gets back into organizational preservation. This last thing we wanted to talk about, and we're right there in the last 5 minutes of our available time. And this is perfect because churches themselves started going down this path in the Second Awakening. I lay this out, that the Second Awakening was about making the local minister evangelical, you know, minister what have you. It gives them the ability to pocket money as a profession. So in other words, they can go from town to town and take, if you want to call them tithes, donations, sacrifices, whatever, and they pocket this money for their own benefit, and they leave. And so when bad times befall that people in that town, who do they turn to? Because the money's gone. In right. The old days, that money was left to the church to take care of the parishioners. The person who led the church, John Adams' father, was a cobbler and was the minister of their local church.
Yes. Yes.
So we become corrupted in the church when all of a sudden a pastor's, you know, money was based on his sermons instead of him actually supporting his family. Christianity was a layman's church, the way Christ laid it out, and even going back way, way back up until the Levitical tribe. When the Levitical tribe was established, then that was the tribe of the priesthood. And so when, you know, Levi, and they were the ones that did the administering, and the people took care of that tribe, right? Their job wasn't to go out and mend, tend to flocks and so forth, and they had a righteous responsibility. But the fact of the matter is that was the old Mosaic law. When you look at Christ, Christ didn't tell his apostles to, you know, start, you know, taxing the people to put in your pockets and take care of your families. No, he actually said that you need to take care of your families as well as the administering of the church. And so they were to, you know, rely upon the people for their sustenance while they were, you know, traveling, but they still had a responsibility to their wives and families.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there are many things here. I don't want to take you off, though. I want you to stick on this. Brent talks about, I think, you know, he might be a little older than he is a little older than the both of us, I'm certain. I think we're close in age. But his pastor you know, he drove the school bus as well. So, I mean,
right.
Then that wasn't all that long ago. But, you know, there were these large evangelists who do exactly what you said. They sponge up all the money and there's nothing left for the local community. But please go on with this organizational thing, because I want you to flesh this out.
Yeah. So organizations, as soon as an organization forms, the organization 9 times out of 10 takes on a life of preservation. It is the destiny of the organization to maintain relevance, just like the NAACP, just like labor unions. Every organization that created or formed to solve a very particular problem, once the problem was solved, once the laborers were no longer working on dirt floors, then they found another problem. They constantly became this perpetuating organization of self-preservation. And constantly pulling in dues or what have you. NAACP, all of these organizations have done this. You know, if you look at the John Birch Society, they formed to stop communism. Well, they've really failed, and they're still bringing in money. And they're telling people that, hey, keep on supporting us. Now,
NRA is the same way.
And there are great people in every single one of these organizations, good yes. patriots, but the patriots have a problem in recognizing that this organization is about self-preservation, and they place priority on preserving the organization over the Constitution. Yes. The Republican Party is equally as culpable, and churches are equally culpable. Churches started turning their backs on their people back in the day because the evangelical movement started, and it was really prominent in the South and the mid, I'll just call it the Midwest or the mid part of the states, that during Andrew Jackson's tenure, pastors came up to the state because they weren't getting their fair share, because evangelical troops would come through and take the money, and they would be left trying to take care of the parishioners. So they went to Andrew Jackson when there was a real downturn in the economy. He says, you have to do something to create jobs for these people. And he violated the Constitution, creating some road projects. And in doing so, he started placating the church. And this is when the church started creating a common pathway to the government to say, you've got to give the, you know, make, create jobs for the people so that the people can work, so we can keep our money, because we're going to go bankrupt. We got to be able to take care of the souls of the people. And this is where the churches started abdicating the responsibility of the temple, or the temporal welfare of, you know, educating, of employing or helping people get jobs, and, you know, administering health care and all of those types of things. The church really literally started abdicating its responsibility so it could cling on to the donations that it was getting for its own use. So today there's an organization called the Circle of Protection. And if you go and look at all of the organizations that are the signatories, and if you want, I can send you this. It's actually on my Reclaiming the Republic website. You can look at all the signatories. What church isn't represented there? I mean, every church is committed to growing the entitlement state so that they can keep more and more of the money they bring in.
The Circle of what again is it?
Circle of Protection.
Okay. And then, of course, you must be aware of another crushing blow, and that was LBJ's 501c3 of the church, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's how the government felt that they could subjugate the church. But again, that in itself is a law-respecting religion. It's a violation of the Constitution.
Yes, yes, all day long.
All right. Day long. So every time I turn around, when you really look at it, they go, well, here's a legal problem. I go, that's not a legal problem. It's an unconstitutional problem. Anyway, I really appreciate the fact of you come forward and willing to talk about these types of things. I would highly recommend that if you listen on a regular basis, download the podcast or what have you. I cover lots of these things, but I wanted to kind of bring you up to speed of some of these things that I cover on a regular basis. And as a matter of fact, in my shows, I actually try to take different angles of approaches so that people can see, because sometimes the frontal approach, somebody doesn't get it. Sometimes you have to see it from the back end or the side, to a blank view or something. So it helps to, you know, for me to try to take these different approaches. And sometimes it's hard for me to see that different approach as well, because I only see it a certain way. So anyway.
And thank you very much. I appreciate your time and your thoughts and your energy. It means a lot to me that you take the time to answer my questions. So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. I'm here to help, and I'm not from the government. That's what I tell people. So anyway, thank you so much for your time. And folks, we're going to be right back after a promo. And so I don't have a lot of time when we come back. So we'll just kind of do a quick wrap and help you get ready for the next episode. So we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so just for a few seconds that we have left in this show, I want to just give you some introspect or some reflections that I have done. You know, over the course of probably almost a decade, I have found that it's as much as I understand where we need to go, there are just pieces of the puzzle that over time, those pieces fall into place. Those pieces actually make the macro picture even more clear and better for me to understand. And so this is how I start to understand and recognize the role that, you know, organizations like NLA have. People such as, you know, Sheriff Mack and other organizations that we're touching with and we're getting engaged with. And so it's an interesting ride. As a matter of fact, as the Grateful Dead said in Trucking, what a long, strange trip it's been. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And in our next episode, please stay tuned. You're going to love it. Thank you so much.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.